Hey there, everyone. Thanks for listening to Limited Engagement. I'm your host for the show, Jared Duran. On this episode, we are going to have a conversation with Michael Chin, who wrote a book that Hoot & Waddle published late last year called Circus Folk. He's got another couple more books as well. We recorded the conversation at the hotel in San Antonio when we were there for AWP. I drove there. I didn't fly. Didn't get sick. No symptoms. So we'll get to that in a sec. And this actually wasn't even supposed to be Mike's episode. It was supposed to be someone else. But this got pushed up in the running order because of pandemic-related cancellations. So there's that going on. Do we want to talk about that for a minute? Is everybody well-stocked on toilet paper? I'm not. I did not go out, rush out, and panic buy. I'll be okay for a little while, but hoping that there's some restocking soon. The whole panic buying thing is ridiculous, by the way. We're not at that point where the supply chain is broken down and just going out there and buying it all up before anybody else can. When I don't know, whatever. I'm sure there's some, people who would say that, that's the right thing to do. Get as much as you can so you're set and your neighbor's fucked. Because that's what it ends up being, right? I mean, you go into these stores and all the paper products are gone. Wipes, tissue, paper towels, yes, it's an issue. It is certainly concerning, but we've all got to be responsible. And still, I don't know, kind, that would be good. Maybe thinking about other people a little bit. What about the people who can't get to the store, and rely on a service to bring them something, and now they're all out and can't get it. I don't know. Well, this is definitely serious. I'm working remotely for the foreseeable future, which I'm really looking forward to, actually. I've wanted to do that for a long time, so I'm actually pretty excited about that. Get a lot more done when there aren't a bunch of people around. Then I definitely have the personality and whatchamacallit. I don't know, something. I work well alone. The most distracting thing I have is my cat. Susu will both be delighted and confused that I'm here so much and will probably pester me quite a bit. So there's that. But what are we going to do? We've all got to carry on in some fashion and just adapt and figure it out. But the panicking really just doesn't do anybody any good. Responsible reactiveness, use some common sense. Yes, avoid large groups of people whenever possible. Yes, wash your hands frequently, or at all in some cases. All you people out there, and there are plenty who use the public restroom and walk right out without washing your hands. Not going to say you deserve to get it, but maybe rethink some habits. And, you know, if you are feeling ill, stay home. It's the responsible thing to do. There's that whole responsibility thing. Anyway, I do hope everybody out there listening is okay and that you are acting responsibly, that you're stocked well enough. I think, you know, it's, if the whole panic thing can just calm down a little bit, it's going to be okay. This is the sort of thing that's just, you know, you have to wait it out. You know, follow the recommendations of the CDC. And, you know, stay home and watch a movie instead. So started rewatching Legion, actually, because there's FX on Hulu now. This is not a paid plug for Hulu or FX. But I'll put a plug out there for Legion because, A, it's done. So, you know, a bunch of new viewers aren't necessarily going to help it out any. But it's a fantastically just fucked up, weird show. Wonderfully bizarre. Some great acting, great writing in there. It's, you know, not like any other superhero thing you're going to watch. I think I might have said that before when I was watching the first and second season. But now I can watch the third season. And I've chosen to go ahead and start over from the beginning. I'm into season two now. It's fun, fucked up. Check it out. If you're in the mood to maybe poke fun at the whole end times vibe we've got going on, I did watch and enjoy Marc Maron's new special on Netflix, End Times Fun. I thought that was pretty good. You know what? If you want suggestions on things, throwing out stuff all the time on Twitter at @LTD_engagement and Instagram at @LTD_engagement. Still staying off Facebook as much as possible. And you know, there's still find ways to connect with people. You know, one-on-one, if you guys are careful, that's perfectly good. Small groups. This whole social distancing thing, I've been prepared for this for a long time. You know, the more distant, the better, to be honest. And the smaller the group, also the better. It's just much more comfortable for me. So this is my wheelhouse. I know how to function in these times. If you want to email, I'll just get the rest of this business stuff out of the way since I'm kind of quasi-remembering it this time. ltd.engagement@gmail.com if you're interested in talking. If you want to come over and record, I am open to that. I keep a clean recording area. And again, I am not exhibiting any symptoms. And were I would responsibly cancel things. There's also probably, I hate doing it because I think there are some things that suffer, such as quality of sound and just the overall conversation. But I am also willing to figure out how to maybe connect through Skype or something and record that way. So there's that. The next thing I'll go ahead and plug while getting back to the topic of my guest, Michael Chin. He, as I mentioned, has written a book, a collection of stories, kind of dark speculative fiction, called Circus Folk, that was published by Hoot & Waddle late last year. It's available if you go to hootandwaddle.com and click on the shop. You can buy it there. You can also order it through Amazon. You can order it through your local bookstore. If they buy through small press distribution, you can order it through your local bookstore. But you can get it just about anywhere that you want to. And if you, you know, doing it directly through us gets us the most support. So I'm going to encourage that. If you want to further support this podcast and Hoot and Waddle in general, there are some, you know, long-term monthly sustainable options of doing so. If you go to patreon.com/hootandwaddle, there are various support levels there. And yeah, and there's that. Wash your hands. And enjoy this conversation with Michael Chin.
Let's go. So, overall, how was your conference?
I had a really good time. I got to do, you know, a couple readings and a few signings and see some old friends. So yeah, kind of everything I would hope for.
Yeah. As we're apparently in some sort of apocalyptic, epidemic kind of thing. How did you? Because you were at Portland last year, right?
Right. Yeah.
So how did you notice, because we didn't leave the book fair area, how sparse were the rooms, the talks you went to and stuff?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd say, you know, where I saw it the most was the book fair itself. Mm-hmm. I only got over to two different talks, but when I was at those, they were actually pretty full. And I think it might be one of those things where, because a lot of talks were canceled, this one actually ended up, you know, the ones that did run ended up being a little bit busier.
Gotcha.
So yeah, it was more of the book fair where just, you know, a lot of the booths were unmanned, or, it wasn't like that crowd of people you have to kind of fight your way through, you know, just kind of a single file, kind of easy stream of people kind of to maneuver through that.
Yeah. Yeah. It was okay. It's kind of crazy, like, you know, they just canceled South by Southwest, they pushed the premiere of the new James Bond movie back.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, what is coronavirus going to take next, you know? It's but so this was not your first rodeo though, and so what I kind of want to get to is kind of the road to how you ended up, you know, here in the world of academia, you've had multiple books published at this point. We'll get to it. Let's start at the beginning a little bit. So what, we were talking earlier, you mentioned that you were, you're originally from New York. Is that right?
That's right. Yeah.
Did you say Utica?
Yeah. Utica, New York, right in the middle of the state, geographically speaking.
I'm very happy with myself that I remembered that, because my memory today is already gone. What was your family doing there?
So my parents were both software engineers, and that's how they met, was in grad school. They both grew up in New York City and kind of got shipped up to Utica to do their jobs at General Electric and to do grad school there. They met that way, and that's what they were doing early on. And then when my sister came, she's my older sister, that's when my dad kind of retired from work. And so he was the stay-at-home dad for her and then for me a few years later. And that was kind of our upbringing there.
That's not the norm, at least for the time that, because I would imagine we're probably roughly the same age. You don't expect, or that's not the traditional situation necessarily. So that's kind of cool. What was the decision with that? Just who was making the more money, or?
Well, yeah, I mean, and they had essentially the same job. So my understanding is they kind of just talked and decided that they wanted one of them to be a stay-at-home mm-hmm. parent, just for kind of, you know, cost effectiveness. And they're both sort of city people who I think were kind of, you know, we can definitely get by on this one salary and we don't know anybody here who we really trust. So,
gotcha.
You know, let's do this. And I think my mom was more ready to kind of say like, no, I'd rather go back to work and have a life outside the house. And my dad was like, well, cool, I'll just hang out and be with the kids. So.
Nice. Works out. So what was Utica like growing up?
Well, yeah, and it's one of those things where it's funny because like my perception has changed a lot over time. I think I was raised to think it was a super small town because my folks were, you know, from the big city. And I've come to kind of recognize as I, you know, experience more places and get to know more people who are actually from small towns and things mm-hmm. like that, that it was actually, you know, it's a small city, but it was like, you know, something in the neighborhood, like 50, 60,000 people. So like, it wasn't tiny by any means.
Yeah, that's not, yeah, comparatively to, you know, even some of the places I drove through on the way over here.
Yeah,
yeah. it's... So where does the were you raised in a pretty creative household? Was there a lot of emphasis on the arts for you?
Yeah, you know, I think that we sort of had the freedom to sort of pursue what we wanted to in that way. Mm-hmm. It's one of those kind of funny things that I don't consider either my parents very literary people. I mean, my mom reads a fair bit, but that's about the extent of it. But I came to learn that both of them had tried writing at various points in their life. Like, huh. My mom wrote Star Trek fan fiction for a while before fan fiction was really a thing, so I don't think she knew what to do with it beyond just, you know, writing it for herself. And my dad was trying to write books about, like, gambling, because he has kind of a problem with gambling. Like, not over the top, but you know, like strategies though of like best ways to gamble and things like that, that I found a draft of at one point.
Wow.
So you know, to that extent, I think it was kind of subliminally in us that, you know, that's something that we could do. But my sister and I were both very you know, kids who wrote stories all the time and who drew pictures all the time, and kind of I think kind of set up a template that we were both going to go in sort of that direction in one way or another.
Gotcha. And what is your sister a writer as well?
Yeah. So I won't say a lot because she kind of keeps a secret identity around
okay,
it.
Sure.
But she writes erotic romance.
Oh, okay. So that's the reason for the secret identity. There's definitely a marker
for that. Oh, there absolutely. She's actually published pretty prominently and done really well for herself. So
all right. Yeah. That's cool. But you went a different, more literary route. What was who were some early influences on you that really got you to, like, sort of as an impetus, and maybe not even writers necessarily, because it's not always the same. I know for me, writing early on was came out of a love of music. So it's not always necessarily literature, but people who might have you know, made you think, you know, I need to write this, you know, I need to put some stories out there.
Yeah. You know, and I think that there's all kinds of stages. I mean, as a little kid, I think the first stories I wrote were all video game centric, and we're talking, you know, original NES, Nintendo. And so I was writing about Mario and about Simon Belmont from the Castlevania games and things like that. But you know, in terms of getting, you know, more into reading, which is kind of my gateway to writing more formally. Mm-hmm. There was a series of books by Patricia C. Reed called the Enchanted Forest Chronicles, which were very, you know, fantasy, but also pretty feminist for their time. You know, the female protagonist who was very much kind of saving the day for herself and things like that. And then really when I got into high school, John Irving was kind of my guy. And,
gotcha.
Was the first one who I kind of just started devouring, you know, 500 page novels from, and kind of started taking, you know, my cues from him about what I wanted to do in writing. I was already starting to write my own stories. That's when I started writing novels. Huh. And they were bad. I mean, they were, I have no illusions about that at this point, but that was definitely a, you know, big influence just in thinking about things with a larger scope, in terms of writing, kind of thinking of book length things. And mm-hmm. I think that there's still a piece of that. I think, you know, Irving is kind of problematic from a contemporary perspective. I think he sort of gets maligned unfairly in some ways, but yeah. Nonetheless, I don't, you know, really champion his work anymore. But I think even now, you know, I tend to write shorter stuff, but a lot of it is sort of linked, or I have overlapping characters at least. Mm. And I think there's some of the roots of that are kind of in his sprawling works, where characters would kind of weave in and out of things and kind of cover a lifetime in those ways.
Well, there's such, I mean, I think the first full-length thing that I wrote was trying to somehow combine, like, Vonnegut and Woody Allen and Douglas Adams, you know, so it's like, first of all, you know, and certainly Woody Allen is problematic, and I don't, you know, I quit championing his work, you know, there's just so much stuff you eventually can't ignore. But there's also historically too, so many of those, you know, like, Mailer and, you know, even like Hemingway and all these hugely misogynist, writers that it's difficult to really, you know, champion them for who they were, but their writing is still, you know, for still influential for so long. How can you, I mean, how can you ignore that? But the larger point that I think I was trying to drive at is that I think that, you know, to a person, that writers are like have to exercise those works that are derivative of everything they've absorbed before they can find their own writing voice. And even then, there's still some, you know, anybody can say, you know, they can probably tell some influences in there somewhere, but eventually you find that you're not writing somebody else's work anymore. You're writing your own.
Right.
And what was that breakthrough for you? When did you feel like, this, you know, this is me, this is not everything I'm a product of. This is actually my voice.
Yeah, it's a great question. And I feel like those years, you know, in high school and in college, I was kind of still grasping for something like that, and, you know, would have told you that some of the work I was writing then was kind of my breakthrough. And in retrospect, like, I was really into those WB shows, like Dawson's Creek and Felicity, all that. And I think I was, you know, heavily influenced by them for a little while. And then I wrote a very dystopian novel that in retrospect, you know, really rips off 1984 pretty badly. And so, you know, I think it was a little while after that, that, you know, I started, there was a point in my mid-20s when there's a novel I first drafted, you know, late in high school. And I kind of, you know, I kind of let it go during college. I kind of decided I'm not a good enough writer yet to pull this off, and I think it's going to be really good. And I spent a few years in my 20s trying to go back to that and redrafting and, you know, just kind of reimagining the whole thing. Before finally I came to a point that like this thing just isn't really working. Like I could always, you know, self-publish or something, but I don't really believe in this project. It's got a few kind of gaping holes I've never figured out how to fill in. And I think when I let that project go, of all things, I think that there was a little bit of that, like, I've invested so much time, I can't possibly let this go now. I've got to, you know, see it through. But I think when I did let it go, it kind of just kind of released the floodgates of, like, you learned a lot in the course of drafting this thing over and over and, you know, getting into a writing practice and all. Go ahead and apply this to something that could actually work. And that's when I started writing. Some of the stories ended up in my first story collection and, you know, a bunch of projects that haven't, you know, fully worked out. But and not too long after that, that's where I first started writing the stories that became Circus Folk as well. And yeah, so I think those were kind of my breakthroughs of sort of, you know, I kind of growing up as a writer and kind of letting go of some of the influences that I think I was too beholden to for too long, and trying to kind of, you know, do the same thing over or get it right with a project that wasn't going to be right.
Gotcha. So was that a straight through line for you? Was that straight from you know, high school into an English emphasis in college into an MFA program?
It was direct, but kind of circuitously direct, if that's not too much of a contradiction. So I was an English major in college, and I was the editor of my college newspaper, which got me in a really good writing habit because I just was writing really prolifically for that purpose. In retrospect, I don't think I was taking, you know, my creative writing seriously enough at that point. I was still, you know, doing it to an extent, but I think it was the years to follow. I worked a couple office jobs, and I wound up doing an MA program part-time, where basically I was just taking one class a semester, night school. And, you know, and it was a program that was not very selective. So basically it was kind of, I think they let in, you know, around half the people who applied. So it wasn't completely non-selective, but not super selective either.
It was like a coin flip kind of selective.
Yeah. And, you know, and I worked with some writers who were clearly further along than I was, but I also worked with a lot of writers where it was like, really, a graduate writing program for you? And, you know, not to be mean, they're very nice people, but, you know, just...
All come from good homes.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. But during that time, I think I started to really hone in on some of the stuff that we were talking about, where, you know, writing stories that were, you know, different, and also just reading a lot more prolifically and diversely during that time. And I think that just kind of opened my eyes to other things I could do. And that's where, you know, I started writing, you know, again, some of the stories that, you know, led to books. But then I, you know, pursued the MFA full time, and I went through this kind of ridiculous process where I applied to 34 programs.
Wow.
Because I had a mentor who kind of insisted that was like the way to do it. Because he
just applied as many as you possibly
could. Yeah. Well, you know, and I think he knew that I was working full time, so I could, you know, if I would just, you know, manage my money for a year or so, I could do that.
Gotcha.
Although it was not cheap. But yeah, so I just applied, you know, to, you know, basically every, you know, name place and a lot of not so name places. Mm-hmm. And just kind of, you know, waited to see where the chips would fall, and, you know, ended up having some options, which was great. And, you know, so I ended up at Oregon State, which I think is one of the schools I would have applied to anyway. Cause like before I kind of fell under his tutelage, I was like, I'll probably apply to like 10 places. You know, mm-hmm. that seems like a good number, and, you know, I'm sure I'll get into at least one. I think I would have gotten into Oregon. Well, I don't know if I would have gotten to Oregon State, but I think I would have applied there anyway. But I think under his kind of mentorship and kind of revising stuff, that was huge for kind of, you know, my process and kind of getting stuff in shape to go to an MFA program. And then when I was there, that's where things, I just kind of went to the next level, because I was just sort of immersed, you know, in just doing the writing, you know, full time for 2 years. And yeah, off from there.
Who did you get to work with there?
So Marjorie Sander was my my advisor and kind of my biggest influence while I was there. But there were some other great people there, though. Nick Dybeck, who's more famous, Father Stuart Dybeck, you know, is obviously great. But Nick's a great novelist in his own right. And he had just arrived in Oregon when I got there. So I got to kind of, you know, work with him. In a way that I feel like, I bet he is kind of, I don't mean this in a gotten better kind of way, but he's probably more polished in terms of his presentation, as he was sort of, you know, this is my first time teaching MFA students. What do I do? And like, they're already good writers. I've taught undergrad. But he was such a great mentor in kind of the sentence level stuff. And so I always credit him with just fixing, you know, little idiosyncrasies in my stories and paying attention to details. So him, you know, Keith Scribner was great to work with there as well, as another novelist. Elena Passarello is there, as, you know, she does creative nonfiction, but was, you know, just someone who really educated me a lot about publishing and literary magazines and all that sort of stuff. And Susan Jackson Rogers is there, and Jennifer Richter, the poet, who helped break me into doing some prose poetry kind of stuff and other, you know, more experimental things than would have necessarily been in my wheelhouse, you know, going into the program.
Nice. So you mentioned that you were the editor of your newspaper. Did you ever consider going into journalism rather than the lucrative career of creative writing?
Yeah, it's kind of, yeah, damned if you do, damned if you don't, right. I guess either way. But I briefly considered it. And I think that the realization I came to was I was both really attached to that college experience and knew it wasn't going to be the same pursuing it as a career. Mm-hmm. And also I just had never taken any actual, you know, journalism or communications courses, and so I was like, if I really wanted to pursue this, I kind of got to start over in some sense.
Totally new track. Yeah,
and I always kind of knew that I wanted to go a more creative track ultimately, and it was, and I sort of assumed, like, you know, unless I just kind of, you know, have some remarkable kind of, you know, J.K. Rowling type experience where the book explodes, I'm going to have to work a normal job in the meantime anyway. So
yeah, because that's like 0.01%.
Yeah, I mean, there's a statistic I always cite to my students now who are, you know, interested in careers in writing, and I tell them, the odds of being a full-time writer who doesn't have other professional commitments and having like a middle class or better kind of living, it's more realistic to be an NBA basketball player. So if you're really good at basketball, that's a safer choice.
you have to pursue writing with the Han Solo never tell me the odds, you know, because it's not never gonna get you much of anything. If that's it's absolutely true. You don't get into writing for the money. But so what kind of, you know, did you feel like you honed, or kind of arrived at what your, writing editorial process was at that point? Or is that something that's evolved over time since you've been out of the MFA program, or?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's continually evolving, but I will say I think my time in the MFA was probably the fastest period of acceleration on that, if nothing else. You know, and one of the big takeaways that was pretty indirect, because obviously no one steered me directly towards this, but I started writing a lot about professional wrestling at that point, where I've been sort of a lifelong nerdy fan of of this form. And, you know, I'd written a couple stories about it, and I'd done some writing online, you know, sort of, you know, just like the columns and whatnot. Mm. But I think I sort of, you know, however directly or indirectly, kind of got the guidance of like write into your passions. Like gotcha. You know, there might be some stigma with some people about this, but you're probably not writing for those people anyway. So, you know, if you've got material, you know, write about this. So, you know, so I wrote a lot of stories that, you know, led to a chapbook and led to my most recent book. And so that's been, you know, it's been good to me. So, you know, not to say that's kind of my only route, or I want to be pigeonholed as a writer of that genre specifically, but mm-hmm. But yeah, the kind of just that permission to pursue whatever sounds cool to me, as opposed to, you know, kind of trying to fit a more, you know, conventional literary standard.
I think that that's such a, you know, well, because I, at least, you know, especially you can fall into this. I don't think it happens maybe as much anymore, because I hear a lot different now and a lot more encouragement of, you know, just writing, what you're saying, writing into your passions, writing what it makes sense for you to write, rather than trying to shape your writing to meet some expectation.
Right.
But I remember, you know, being in workshop classes and not, or you know, because my writing is full of pop culture references. Sure, just yeah. All the time. You know, I'm a huge pop culture junkie, and you know, being one of the few people who would have work that would have any sort of sense of humor to it, it was all everything must be serious and about pain, and you know, and of course, so when I was in these workshops, I'd taken years off because, you know, a number of life things, but you know, I was pretty typically close to 10 years older than a lot of the other kids in the workshop, right? And it's interesting too to be in a situation where you're trying to write something genuine when you just have not had a ton of life experience,
right?
You know, but it seems like and there was a person who stopped by the Hoon Waddle table at the book fair mentioning that she'd had a person who led a workshop she was in that gave her a bunch of shit for having any humor in her essays, that it was like not, you know, this was not acceptable kind of thing. It's just ridiculous. You know, that's that idea that that you have to write if you're in an academic track, that you have to write what's expected of an academic track. You know, I think that's changing though, as some of the older guard is getting pushed out of a lot of those programs, or aging out, I guess.
Yeah, I mean, cause I'll say at my program that, you know, I would place most of the people I worked with as fairly traditional in their own work.
Mm-hmm.
But I never heard any backlash when I, you know, wrote a story, you know, about wrestling, or when I brought in some of this kind of magical realism. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's kind of an ongoing joke. You know, there's that whole idea that, you know, in a workshop, everyone starts to write kind of the same sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember it was sort of a joke because we were all doing such different things, but a lot of us started incorporating ghosts in some form or another, whether it was, you know, very literally or clearly kind of a metaphor.
Uh-huh.
And in different enough ways, it didn't feel like it was really influencing each other. But something I really appreciated was no one batted an eye at it, you know, and sort of said like, wow, no, we're never going to publish any of this stuff.
Gotcha.
It seemed to be pretty, you know, agreed upon, like, okay, this is interesting on its own terms, and we'll kind of, you know, run with that.
Mm-hmm. How, as far as when did you start? Have you just always been submitting work? What was your kind of first, or how did you? At what point did you decide, you know what, this stuff is good enough that I'm going to send it out to journals? And what's your kind of go-to process for that, as far as, you know, finding the right places to go ahead and submit your work?
Yeah, you know, my introduction to it was Allison Josephs, the poet, runs this this list of kind of, you know, submission opportunities, and I forget who turned me on to it, but it used to be just an email thing that she would send out with, you know, all these different places you could submit. Now it's a blog; it's kind of transitioned over time, but that was kind of my gateway of, like, I didn't know what any literary magazine was really, besides, like, you know, the New Yorker or the Paris Review, and so that was just like, oh cool, these are places that are actively looking for submissions, as opposed to, you know, me just sending to an infinite slush pile and they don't really, you know, care about my work.
Right.
And so, you know, obviously I still got, you know, way more rejections than acceptances, but that's how I started to collect, you know, my first, you know, very small handful of acceptances.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and then when I was in grad school, I just started, you know, really aggressively pursuing it, just because I was starting to churn out a lot of work and getting a little bit less precious about it in a way. I think, you know, for a while, I think I was very conservative about, like, it's got to be perfect. I'm going to revise it, you know, umpteenth times before I, you know, even consider sending it out. And especially, I took this class on hybrid forms where I started writing a lot of prose poems coming out of it. And it was sort of a big release for me, because I kind of, you know, thought, well, A, I've got like 50 of these things lying around now, and B, like, I kind of stake my reputation on being a fiction writer to the extent that I have any reputation. So if I you know, publish this in, I think literally I published a place called The Rat's Ass Review, that, you know, isn't going to go on my CV or anything, but, you know, it's a way of just getting the work out there. So doing things like that, where I was just kind of making more connections with it. And then as I started to, you know, get some traction there, you know, I think that there's a point at which, you know, people are focused too much on submission. I think I've gotten there. It's at certain points where, no, it'd be better if I just, you know, put this through as paces of revision a few more times and didn't worry about sending it out. And that's always a, you know, a balance I'm kind of trying to strike. But I also try to maintain that, you know, it's never going to be 100% perfect, and some pieces are going to have a ceiling on them. And so my general philosophy is I'd rather have it out in the world somewhere than just kind of, you know, buried in a drawer. Sure. Unless it's, you know, I have it in some stuff that's just bad, right? We all do.
Yeah, obviously. But I mean, you can always go back and, you know, if you have the opportunity anyway, if you want to include it in a collection, you can always revise before it's
right.
In a collection. Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you hold on to old drafts in case you feel like you ever lost something in subsequent revisions?
Yeah, you know, and I think that it's one of the best things about the era that we write in now is it's really easy to have backups of things. Mm-hmm. So, I once lost a significant chunk of that novel I was talking about earlier during one of the revision processes, and was so mad at myself because I hadn't sent myself a backup in too long. That was kind of, you know, where I learned, like, you know, I'm going to email myself backups constantly. And so I started doing it at least daily if I was working on something, you know, that regularly.
Gotcha.
So I've always at least got, you know, that file that was sent to myself. And I usually email it from one email account to a different email account. So it's kind of in two places. And so, you know, it's always there to go back to, although I think it's pretty rare that I end up going back to a much earlier draft, unless it's like, you know, today I really botched it. I've gone back to yesterday's version of it.
Huh. Have you ever just written something and been so happy with it you see no need for revision at all?
That may have happened with a small number of the prose poems specifically. Mm-hmm. I think, and you know, it's you know, too much of a generalization, but I think in general, the shorter the work, oftentimes I find the less revision I'll kind of put it through. Where with, you know, a really short prose, like one of the ones I published, I remember, was like, you know, two sentences long. And so like that one, it's like, well, if unless it's going to be a different poem, there's not going
to
be, you know, that much I can revise
at that point, right?
Yeah, yeah. Right. So, yeah. But no, usually, I mean, you know, at least kind of that, you know, for that kind of work, at least kind of a proofreading round and let me have this sit there for a week or two and revisit it to make sure that it actually seems right to me.
Mm-hmm.
But for anything more substantial than that, though, I do believe it needs, you know, some more intensive revision, and, you know, not necessarily always like a holistic, like I've got to just reimagine this whole thing or have it sit for, you know, months or whatnot. But at least letting it sit for, you know, a period of days and coming back to it and, you know, tinkering to that extent.
Sure. Do you ever feel too close to something you've written in order to be like the person who can really be the person to kind of tear through it?
Yeah, you know, and I think that's, you know, I'm a prolific first drafter, and I think probably that's my greatest strength as a writer, and I think probably my greatest weakness is I'm often, you know, think after I finish a draft, like, this is great. Like you know, I should just, you know, fine-tune, proofread, and then start sending it out there. Mm-hmm. I had a recent experience with some stories I'm pretty excited about that I was just in touch with an old mentor. We were just kind of catching up over email, and you know, he kind of offered, like, you know, we'd have some stories ready, you know, let me know again. I'd be happy to look at them for you. He had me mail them to him hard copy, and, you know, he emailed me back, you know, a letter that bluntly said, these stories are nowhere near ready. Do not send these to anyone. And went on like a 1,000-word rant on why they weren't, and he marked up every page about, you know, and he gave some commentary feedback too. I didn't think they were completely, you know, dead in the water, but but it was so valuable, right? And I think that we all kind of need those reality checks every now and again.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
You know, and I often, you know, he's kind of, his name is Harvey Groeschinger. You know, he actually also mentored Carmen Maria Machado when she was earlier in her career, and a number of other people who've gone on to do some really cool things. And so, you know, I often try to impose his voice when I'm thinking to myself, like, is this ready or not? And kind of as a litmus test for, you know, not so much the poetry, not so much stuff I'm sending out a little bit more casually, but, mm-hmm. you know, when I'm, you know, going to send something off to, you know, more prestigious venues or whatnot, or when I'm finishing up your revisions of a book draft, like what would Harvey say about this? Right. like would he kind of say like, no, this is nowhere near ready to me. Or would he say, no, this is a good one. Like, mm-hmm. here's the little things you need to do. You know, but try and have those voices in your heads, I think, is important.
Huh. There's something I want to touch on just briefly, because I'm also a fan of the show. But you did recently a blog about rewatching Buffy.
Is that Yeah.
Was that one of the WB shows that was in the rotation for you?
Yeah, and that one I kind of classify it differently, because it's sort of, you know, it certainly was a WB show and it was in the same era, but right. I actually think it was good.
You know? Right. Yeah,
so,
exactly.
So when I go back to, you know, the other ones like the Charmed and the Dawson's Creek, you know, it's like I enjoyed it for what it was at its time, but yeah, Buffy I kind of still hold pretty dear, as, you know, it's got, you know, some elements that haven't aged as well as others, but overall uh-huh. being, you know, both good and yeah, important to me is kind of an influence, and it's something I just really enjoy.
Yeah. Well, that's one that's, you know, like maybe the first season or something is it, when it didn't have its style or voice yet, and then it just takes off.
Yeah, totally.
A good chunk of it. But yeah, it's, I don't know. It's, it's one of those shows that I did not watch it when it was first on at all. I was ahead and ex who said, oh, you got to give this a chance. You'll love it. And I did end up liking it. That's happened with a couple of shows, but, do you ever find like that style? 'Cause that's not there in Circus Folk necessarily, but, do you ever find that kind of mixture of humor and a little bit of horror to it there kind of ever finding its way into your work? Or
yeah, and you know, I think as much as there are significant elements that are very different between a show like Buffy and a project like Circus Folk, I actually feel like there is some overlap to the extent of sort of, you know, taking the world that we know and adding kind of you know, more speculative elements, more magical sure. kind of elements, that things like that. You know, because I think some of the real value of a show like Buffy is like, you know, yeah, the, you know, dusting vampires is cool, and there's right. some, you know, great special effects work for its time, but I think some of the real value is, you know, what it has to say beyond the scope of, you know, the more magical elements that are happening. And, you know, yeah. obviously the whole, you know, high school is hell kind of metaphor, you know, is right. you know, pretty obvious, you know, especially in retrospect, but you know, those later seasons of the show, for example, where you know, she's out of school and when she drops out of college and mm-hmm. she's trying to find herself, you know, I didn't love at the time because I was, you know, a high schooler when most of that was coming out, and then early in my college years,
right.
And now, you know, in my 30s, when I look at it, it's like, oh man, they nailed it, like they got that completely right. Yeah. And so but you know, the way that those things can speak to each other and kind of you know, reveal greater truths, I think, about you know, maybe I didn't have an imaginary sister, you know, dropped into my life and then my memories replaced and so on and so forth, but having the rug kind of pulled out from you and the world isn't what you thought it was, you know, and having to figure that out again, right. like that's totally relatable.
Well, and who hasn't thought that they were living on top of a hellmouth before? You know,
not me. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, you know, kind of actually mining that vein just a little bit in your own life, you know, as far as finding yourself in that kind of thing, you know, post graduate work, that's not an easy time for anybody, because you're in the job market and you're looking for something. And, you know, it's how was that for you? How did you get through that?
Yeah, you know, I think so many people talk about, you know, right out of college, right after a graduate program, you know, kind of having a period of struggle. And yeah, it was an interesting period. So I, you know, finished my MFA and I had applied for a small handful of jobs, but hadn't really applied a lot. I think in part kind of arrogantly thinking, well, one of these jobs is going to work out, so, you know, it'll be fine. And, you know, they never even called me for interviews or, you know, anything along those lines. And then when I did get my first interview for a faculty gig, I kind of tanked it. Like, I had a phone interview where, you know, in a previous life, I did a lot of hiring and did phone interviews of people. So I was like, I've been on the other side of this call a million times. I'm just going to ace this thing, and really tanked it. And it kind of shook me for a little bit. But so, yeah, my wife and I, we got married, a few months after I finished grad school, and then we were kind of bopping around. So we discovered that with Airbnbs that if you do like a full month rental for a lot of them or like a 4-week period, they'll give a drastically cut price to the point where you're basically just paying rent. So we were doing that for a little while we were both applying for jobs and, just kind of trying to figure things out. And, this was during the period when, the 2016 election happened. So, the world was kind of getting turned upside down in and of itself. And I was trying to write a lot during that time, and I was having a fair amount of success with publishing short stuff, but I was also starting to send out book manuscripts and starting to see rejections kind of roll in, and thinking this is not going to be as easy as I thought it might be in terms of getting a book out there in the world. I ended up going back to my old job, and they let me work remotely, which was very kind of them. And so we had a decent salary and benefits for a stretch. Basically, I was filling in for some people who were on maternity leave, which just kind of worked out timing wise. But then, my wife got a full-time gig, and I found adjunct work pretty quickly when we moved to Georgia after that. But it was definitely a period of kind of, struggling in a way I didn't necessarily expect to, and trying to figure out, what really is the next step. I think I kind of settled on the idea. I got to teach during my graduate program and really enjoyed that experience, and went into grad school thinking that was a potential route, but also just kind of thinking, I'm going here to focus on writing for a couple of years, and that's going to be my driving factor. And then it was, now I really like teaching as well, so I want that to be the thing that I'm doing. And adjuncted for, a couple of years, so I got the adjunct work going and was able to teach a pretty steady stream of, three classes a semester, which was, what wasn't sustainable in and of itself, but in a two-income household, we were, okay with that. We had our son was born, in late 2017, and then it was sort of, now we can lay some roots here and this can just be our life. I wasn't entirely happy with sort of the degree of, both professional accomplishment and an income I was bringing in, and just also to be frank, kind of bouncing off the walls, being, stay at home dad for 60-70% of my life, while my wife was going off to work full time and really wanted to be home more. So we were both sort of, discontent, but like functional in that, that way. So when I got, a full-time teaching gig and the opportunity to move us out to Las Vegas, that was sort of, a best case scenario in a lot of ways. And so, nothing's ever, 100% ideal, but,
sure.
But that was kind of light at the end of the tunnel where, our family was in place. I felt more professionally fulfilled. My wife got to walk away from a professional situation that was challenging and, spend more time, at home. And so, it all, to the extent that you can say these things, worked out.
Yes, yeah, right. Yeah. Knock wood or whatever. I don't think there's any wood in here. But now, just to touch briefly anyway on the, it's got to be difficult to find time to write when you're a full-time teacher and you've got a toddler and, did you have a sort of a writer's routine leading up to that, and how has it sort of modified since then?
Yeah, I always say the best thing about not going straight off to an MFA, I think, is that it's not like I went from undergrad straight to grad school and just had limitless time to write and immersion in literary things and all that. For whatever it was, a good 7-year period or so there, I was just, working an office job where most people around me didn't care that much about literature and certainly weren't actively, writing themselves, and having to find time and make time, and I was a bachelor then, and I, was kind of a night owl by nature. And so, time was, fairly plentiful, but still it wasn't like I said all day to do it, I'd work all day and then come home and then having to still, sit myself down and, write for an hour or two.
Yeah.
And so that was good training for what would come after my MFA program, especially after, my son came, where, if he naps for, an hour and a half, 2 hours, that might be literally the only time I've gotten the day to potentially write, much less, catch a nap myself or, do any sort of other, business I should be taking care of. And so sometimes those very finite periods of time I found kind of will drive me of like, okay, there's no choice. Like if you want to do it, you got to do it right now. And right. So, just sitting there and at least, I'm a big believer in, small increments of time, small numbers of words, just kind of adding up. And so, setting goals like 500 words a day or something like that, where, if you only do that for, a few days, you might only end up with, 1,000, 1,500 words. But if you do that for, you know, for a month straight or for 2 months or for 3 months, like you could write a novel essentially, you know? And so, you're trying to let that time add up like that.
And have you done like a NaNoWriMo kind of deal?
I only did NaNoWriMo once. So that was during that fall when I was unemployed. And so that I felt like I vaguely kind of eyed NaNoWriMo. I was like, that sounds kind of cool. And I can write pretty prolifically. So I bet I could do that. But it was always sort of like, well, you know, I've got other real world responsibilities and I don't want to be holding to this thing and yada, yada.
Right.
But yeah, during that time though, it was like, well, I don't have a job. Like we didn't have our son yet. So it was like, well, I might as well just, you know, give this a shot. So yeah, I did it. I drafted a novel. It was fine. Like I think for what NaNoWriMo is, like it was you know, about as good as you can expect, but it also wasn't compelling enough that I've really gone back to it. So it's kind of on the back burner that one day this is a manuscript that if I'm kind of stalled out in other things, I always could go back to. But yeah, that's kind of as far as I got with that project.
Gotcha. And now, so to shift over to Circus Folk, it's not a novel, but the story is all, you know, there's a lot of connection between them, and it does involve, many of the stories involve the same characters, and there is a lot of they all take place very clearly in the same world. So with something like that versus a novel, what is there still then a similar level of outlining and planning and kind of knowing ahead of time, plotting out what your intention is with the work?
Yeah. Yes and no. So that one, I've never had a process quite like it, but basically, the story Clown Faces, which is the second one, in the book, I wrote that first, and I wrote it as kind of a standalone short story. And basically the impetus was, I in my office job, it was like on that show, The Office, where there's a party planning committee. We essentially had one of those for monthly communal birthday parties. And one time it was kind of a fun concept. Basically we just kind of threw in like random, like kinds of things, nouns, and then random kinds of events. So we ended up with a clown prom, as the theme. We didn't end up using it, but I remember I saw like, this is so absurd. I kind of love this. Mm-hmm. I should write something like this. And so in the original draft of that story, there was a clown prom. They all ended up going to, and that ended up getting cut as, you know, revisions happened. Mm. But you know, I loved the world that kind of I got to occupy when I was writing that story. And there was in the revision process, there was the scene that came up where there's Shanaran, who's the dark clown or the kind of the evil clown figure in the story. And her, you know, trying to think about, you know, letting loose this lion, which obviously becomes, you know, pretty prominent throughout the book to follow. But that was sort of the germ for like, wow, this could be something more. I could really like blow this whole world up and just kind of, you know, see where it'll reach, and, you know, tentacles will go in different directions. I remember I was, you know, working full time then, but I went home for the holidays and found myself just sitting in a Panera, and I started writing the story that ended up being Forever, the first story in the collection, out of the Ringmaster, who appears, you know, pretty kind of, you know, briefly and kind of incidentally in Clown Faces. Mm-hmm. And once that story was written, that one came really quickly to me. And then it was sort of like, okay, so now I've got these two pieces in place. I think I want it to be about, you know, this ringmaster and kind of the circus that he's kind of fallen into. And then I started brainstorming different kinds of circus performers. And after that, it was just sort of fun, just sort of imagining what the story could be, what could lead someone into the circus life if they, you know, if a woman had facial hair, like she could be the bearded lady, and just kind of, you know, where we could take off from that.
Right.
And so most of it came pretty organically. And I remember I'd finished, you know, what I thought was a full manuscript of it. And then I took a trip to Las Vegas, completely, you know, coincidental from, you know, I ended up living there, but went to the Circus casino there, and they have live casino performers doing kind of circus things. And this one was doing the trapeze act without a net, I noticed. I was sort of like, you know, I wonder why she's here, right? Because if I doubt anyone would come, you know, to be a circus performer in the middle of a casino in Las Vegas.
Yeah.
And, you know, and how you'd end up there. You know, and that doesn't play so directly into the story of Fallen that ended up being in the collection, but that was the germ of it, of sort of just imagining a trapeze artist, and specifically one who would perform without a net, and, you know, what that could mean. And so, you know, I let those stories sit for a period of years. I workshopped a couple of them, my MFA, but then I sort of decided I was going to focus on other things. And it was only, you know, whatever it was, probably a year and a half out of my MFA that I revisited it. And I was like, huh, this is actually pretty close to a book. And And then I went back, and the main thing I drafted at that stage was all of the little flash pieces about Taming the Lion, because I'd already had, you know, that piece from the very original story, Clown Faces, but with that element of, you know, a self-trained lion tamer. And I kept coming back to, like, there's got to be stories from this. like that's such an absurd thing for anyone to do. And it also provided a vehicle just to bring other characters back around and kind of revisit ones who hadn't gotten enough, you know, time on the page yet, and kind of weave them in some more. But once those were written, you're just kind of going through and revising everything a lot. And I started submitting stories individually, and just kind of, that was kind of my affirmation when a lot of them got published, that, okay, like, these aren't just good to me. Like, these are actually, like, publishable stories. Yeah. And then, start sending the manuscript out.
Yeah. Nice. And then the rest is history. So, but you've had a few things relatively, published relatively close together. Were they all kind of accepted at the same time, or some of these have been in the works for varying periods of time and they just happened to get released close together? Or
yeah,
well, it's kind of wild, you know. You have these dry spells, and then suddenly, you know, at least, you know, and I'm not speaking for you, but for myself personally, where you just, like, nothing, and then bam, you just suddenly, you know, one thing begets another, it seems like.
Yeah, and, you know, I was getting really discouraged about getting a book published. I had a manuscript of stories, mostly that I'd written during my MFA program. Mm-hmm. That I was sending out, and it was, you know, it was pretty consistently just getting, you know, kind of a form rejection, and, you know, not getting any sort of, you know, useful feedback at all. Anyway, I kept tinkering with that and kind of trading out stories and going back and revising some of the ones I didn't think were, you know, quite as strong. And then finally I came to a point where it'd been, you know, at whatever it'd been, like, you know, 2 or 3 years, and, you know, and just no one biting on it. And I said, you know, I'm kind of done sending this out. Like, it was still out at, like, you know, 5 or 6 places. And I was like, well, if any of them bite, awesome, but, you know, let's get the next one ready. And that's when I went, you know, more wholeheartedly back to Circus Folk, and to another collection that actually, is still in the ether. It's out at a few places, although I might be revisiting that one before it ever sees the light of day for real. But I started sending those out to just a, you know, a handful of places that seemed really cool, like Hoot and Waddle, where it was like just kind of like I you know, went to the website, I really like the vibe of this place, I'll give them a shot. And so I had you know, those starting to go out, and then it was within like a 2 week or so period, December 2018, that I got the first book accepted for publication by Duck Lake Books. You Might Forget the Sky Was Ever Blue. We're actually at the aquarium for my son's birthday when I got the email that they were accepting it, and it was pretty wild. And then we were celebrating the holidays with my wife's family when I got the email from Hoot and Waddle saying that they wanted to take Circus Folk. So it was like, I, you know, up until December of 2018, I thought I have no books and, you know, not necessarily a clear path forward on this. And then all of a sudden it's like, okay, sweet, I've got 2 books under contract now. And, and then Cowboy Jamboree Press had reached out to me because they really like wrestling stuff. Cool. And so their header, Adam Van Winkle, is a big fan and writes about wrestling himself. And he was like, yeah, I've read some of your stuff. I'd love to have some of your work, you know, for our website. So I sent him a couple, you know, flash pieces, and he took them. And I had all this wrestling stuff just kind of sitting there because I had a chapbook that I'd published with the Florida Review Press. But with that, it was I'd written a collection of like 40 something of these linked pieces, and that only included like 14 of them. And so I was, you know, I published a lot of the other ones individually, but I was like, I'd really love to get these all in a book together. And I had these other stories about wrestling I'd written. And so I just sent it off to them because they have sort of a, if you've published with us already, we welcome you to send us a manuscript, no promises, but we'll consider it if you've already published, you know, short pieces with us. Nice. And then that one came through, that following spring. So, you know, within like whatever that was, like a 4 or 5 month period, all of a sudden 3 books were accepted. Awesome. And then they kind of came out, you know, in sequence, but
so it can happen.
yeah. So hold out hope, folks. Yeah. Don't stop believing. Yeah.
Well, so as we're kind of just wrapping up here, is there anything that you've got coming out on the horizon? Anything that you wanted to, you know, what's your next project? What are you really excited about doing right now?
Yeah. So, guys, I feel like I always sound like the nerd who just talks about wrestling. He's like the guy in the school bus who's like, hey, guys, did you see Hulk Hogan's match? But I actually do have some more wrestling stories that I wrote over the last fall, and I'm kind of revising now and getting ready ready to send out. I have a Link Flash piece I'm starting to write now, but it's kind of too early to know exactly what it is. Just it's a woman who works at a video store, and I think it's set in the 90s. Cool. I've gone back and forth on whether I want it to be set more contemporary and kind of with that backdrop of like video stores aren't really a thing anymore. So it was kind of a failing business, but I'm still waffling about the time period I want to set it in, but kind of intersecting her life with the movies and things along those lines.
That sounds cool.
But we'll always see. I think it's one of those things where, anyone who's doing like creative things kind of experiences that, you think you're doing one thing and it turns out to be something totally different. We'll find out.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much, man. This was a blast.
It was a lot of fun. Thank you very much. Yeah.
All right, that's it. Thanks as always for listening. Thanks again to Mike for taking the time to sit and talk to me. Again, that book is Circus Folk. He has other books as well. Support the writer. I'll put links up to his other stuff in the show notes. And he has a new podcast. I'll plug that in the show notes as well. So you can check that out. And if you're listening on whatever you're listening on, if it's Apple Podcasts, if you could rate and review the show, that would be hugely helpful. If it's another listening app, you can like it or follow it, subscribe. All those things help get the podcast out there. So wash your hands. Social distancing, small groups, responsible, don't panic. Don't panic. It's going to be okay for most of us. Life will go on. And eventually we'll get back to some form of normalcy, probably. That's going to do it. See you on down the road. This has been a Hoon Waddle production. If you enjoyed this podcast, why not check out one of our other fine podcasts available from hootandwaddle.com, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or any number of podcast apps. If you'd like to support Hoot and Waddle and get access to an exclusive member-only podcast, receive discounts on merch, and more, go to patreon.com/hootandwaddle.